Well, let's turn to Romans chapter 11, and we want to read part of this, or the end of this beautiful chapter. And in Romans 9 through 11, Paul deals with the question of what about the Jews, being that the Gentiles have come in and so forth, and justification by faith and so forth. And he wraps it up here, I'm going to start in verse 25 and read down through the end of the chapter. And he speaks about the salvation of Israel, which is still future. Romans 11, verse 25, he says, "For I do not want you, brethren, to be uninformed of this mystery." Now, I should just stop there. What's a mystery in the Bible? That's not Nancy Drew. A mystery in the Bible is something that was not revealed in the past. It's something that is now revealed. That word is sometimes misused by people. But at any rate, he says, "So that you will not be wise in your own estimation, that a partial hardening has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. And so all Israel will be saved, just as it is written, 'The deliverer will come from Zion, he will remove ungodliness from Jacob.'" Now, Jacob is not the church. Jacob is Israel, right? He's going to remove ungodliness from Jacob. "This is my covenant with them when I take away their sins. From the standpoint of the gospel, they are enemies for your sake. But from the standpoint of God's choice," notice again election, "they are beloved for the sake of the fathers." Who are the fathers? The patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. In other words, what he's saying is this: I made promises to them, and for that reason, I will be faithful to them. Right? He says, we sang, "Great is thy faithfulness." He's faithful. Verse 29, "For the gifts and the calling of God are irrevocable. For just as you once were disobedient to God, but now have been shown mercy because of their disobedience, so these also now have been disobedient, that because of the mercy shown to you, they also may now be shown mercy. For God has shut up all in disobedience so that he may show mercy to all. Oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable are his judgments and unfathomable his ways. For who has known the mind of the Lord, or who became his counselor, or who has first given to him that it might be paid back to him again? For from him and through him and to him are all things. To him be the glory forever. Amen." Well, it has sometimes been said that the greatest evidence of the truth of the Bible is the Jewish people. And I think that's largely true. When we see what God has done with the Jewish people, how he scattered them all through the earth, just as he said, the land was completely and utterly desolate for centuries, yea, millennia, just as he said it would be. And now to see them back in the land, just as he said they would come back to the land, is an amazing statement. You know, there's never been a people ever in the history of the world that has been separated from its land like the Jews for 2,000 years and has maintained its identity. If you would take any people generally and they dispersed across the world, they would be very quickly brought into the cultures around them. God in his providence, and of course through Judaism, kept these people as a unique, distinct group, and now they're back in the land. An amazing statement of God's power and God's providence. Well, what we wanted to do, and we started this last week, is give you a sense of the history. When I say the history of the Middle East conflict, I'm not going into all the Gulf Wars and all that stuff. I'm more thinking about the nation of Israel and, of course, their conflicts with the Palestinians, which is really the centerpiece of the Middle East conflict. The Middle East conflict is Israel. And I want you to understand the history behind how Israel became a nation and what the issues are over there, so that, first of all, so you can glorify God, because truly it is the work of God. It is God's... Again, I'm amazed at people that say there's no future for Jews and for Israel. When you look at Jews in the land and the national Israel right there, It truly is an amazing statement of God's power and God's providence. But also, there's a lot of ignorance about A, how they came into the land, and B, what are the issues. So when you read your paper, oftentimes, you know, what's going on from month, day to day, and week to week, oftentimes there isn't a lot of background as to how we got to where we are. So that's what we're doing, and I hope this turns on, because it doesn't always turn on when it's supposed to. But let me just, while this is warming up, I think it's warming up. While it's warming up, yeah, there we go. Let me review briefly where we were last week. Last week we talked about what actually happened to the land from the time of Christ, basically, to basically World War I. And it was in that time period, it was basically more or less under Muslim rule from about 632 or so, right after Muhammad's death, the Muslims invaded that area. From about that time, 632, up until the fall of the Ottoman Empire in 1917 during World War I, that was basically always under a Muslim rule. Different kingdoms, different Muslims, there were Turks and there were Arabs and there were different, but it was generally under Muslim rule. As we pointed out, the land became completely desolate, arid, there were very few people there generally, a few Bedouins, nomads, and beggars, and peasant farmers, very little law and order throughout the time period. There has never been, and I emphasize this because this is something that papers, I think there's a lot of ignorance regarding, there's never been a Palestinian state, and there have never been Palestinians. Okay, there's never been a group called Palestinians. There has never been a group that has been tied to this land that we call Israel. Okay, it was generally, first of all, very few people to begin with. But at any rate, then we'd looked at a little bit at the rise of Zionism. Zionism being this movement to actually say, hey, the Jews should go back to that land of Israel, their ancient land, and resettle there and start a nation. That's called Zionism. And this thought of Zionism really developed out of persecution, out of really the Enlightenment and partially even the Reformation. But it especially developed in Britain in the 1800s. And then was especially kind of came to the fore with the pogroms of Russia, where there was a lot of persecution of Jews, and the Jewish people started really pressing for this. And we saw some of the original leaders of Zionism. The father of modern Zionism was called, his name was Theodor Herzl, and he started the World Zionist Organization. And then we saw, we talked about Chaim Weizmann, who was also an instrumental leader in that movement. But now the turning point, and this is kind of where we were finishing up last time, the turning point was World War I. Because the Ottoman Empire sided with Germany, and Germany obviously lost the war. And during the war, the Russians, French, and British got together and said, what are we going to do with this Ottoman Empire, the Middle East, the Levant, or whatever you want to call it? What are we going to do with this area when the war is over and we beat the Germans? And they had developed an agreement. It was a secret agreement initially that said there would be an area here, the Russians and Armenia would be in charge, and the French would be over Syria, and the British would be over Palestine and Iraq. That was their agreement. That became public, actually, towards the end of the war. At the same time, the British made a promise to the Arabs that they would have it was a very vague promise, but it was a promise that they would have their own independent state in Syria if they helped them overthrow the Turks and the Ottoman Empire. At the same time, the British made a promise, a public promise, to the Jews in what was called the Balfour Declaration, which we read last time, which basically was a letter to Lord Rothschild in England, who was the most prominent Jew probably in England, and maybe the world, I don't know. He was a prominent banker. Industrialist, whatever, and he made a promise publicly, an intention that the British government intended to start, and they supported the idea of starting a nation in Israel with the Jews. When the war was over, there was a conflict of interest because they had kind of made both of these promises, and the Arabs understood all of that area to be an independent state, and the British said, no, that wasn't really our intention, you know, to give you the whole area. So this was the conflict. There was a lot of politics involved. When the League of Nations met, again, after the war, through our president, Woodrow Wilson, one of the things that they did was they gave a French mandate and a British mandate. The French mandate covered Syria. The British mandate was Palestine. And I think it was basically meant to be temporary. It was to extend, I think, to 1948 is what it was supposed to do. It officially, I think, started in 1923, but the British were basically administering this area from the close of the war. Now, that was the area was called, that, if you could see that there, that's the British mandate, which I think I mentioned this last time, I showed you this last time. You can see Iraq there to the east. Iraq was separate and it became a nation. This area called the British Mandate of Palestine was initially meant to be for the Jews. This is where they're going to have the state of Israel. You can see Syria to the north. That was the French mandate. Okay. So the first thing that the British did in 1922 was created the Transjordan. And they split that into two pieces. And you can see most of it went to the Arabs to the east, and that became Jordan. Okay, so as I mentioned last time, that was really the two-state solution. Because that's exactly what it was. You know, the Arabs were you have to understand this whole time period, the British thought of the Arabs as the most important group politically in this area. So they were especially catering to the Arabs, to the cost of the Jews. So you can see Israel already lost most of its territory in 1922 when they created Transjordan. And by the way, in the Bible, of course, much of what is Transjordan, not all of it, but much of it was part of the nation of Israel, right? Gilead, you know, that old Bashan, that's all that area. Just to describe what happened in the British Mandate, this is about 25, 26 years, whatever. They became a nation in 48, right? So what happened basically during the British Mandate is there was an increased Jewish immigration. Now, Jewish immigration started in earnest in the Promised Land in the 1880s, okay? But this increased during the Mandate. There was increased prosperity. And by the way, this is, I think, also an important point to remember. When the Jews came to the land, it was truly desolate, and there weren't many people. There were some Arabs there, obviously. The Jews bought farms and started working the land and actually made it a prosperous place. They founded cities. They turned the desert literally into a blooming farmland, and it was pretty amazing what they did. And that prosperity, ironically, brought Arabs. But a lot of the prosperity was because of what the Jews had done, because of their immigration, because of their work, and because of their planning, because of their technology. Okay, they're an industrious people. So they brought that prosperity. There was, as the Jews immigrated, there was increased Arab resistance to their immigration because they saw increasingly that they were being outnumbered. And one thing you have to remember about Muslims generally is they are always dominionistic. In other words, generally speaking, in Arab countries, you have more rights if you're a Muslim than if you're anything else, right? Because that's their religion. They're dominionistic. So they want to be in charge, and they want to be, in fact, oftentimes in Arab or Muslim countries, no, you couldn't own land unless you were Muslim, or you know, you had certain rights that you didn't have if you weren't Muslim. You were a second-class citizen if you weren't a Muslim. So there was a lot of resistance to the Jewish immigration, and there were a lot of uprisings, Arab uprisings, riots, violence against Jews. And to be fair, there was some the other direction as well. There was Jewish violence against Arabs as well, but it was generally Arab resistance. And then in 1939, famously, right before, again, this was during what? This is during World War II, right? They, to please the Arabs, the British famously basically closed Jewish immigration into the land. And they literally, while the Holocaust was going on in Europe, there were shiploads of Jews that they would not let them enter the Promised Land. again, because of the Arabs, and there's some famous anecdotes around that whole thing. But at any rate, that kind of describes what took place during this time period. The British had their hands full, to say the least, in governing this area. They had committed themselves to a Jewish state, but they were at the same time trying to appease the Arabs, and it caused a great deal of conflict. And the British, I think I mentioned this last week, it's interesting actually, if you read the history, the British did a lot to actually incite Arab anti-Semitism and the British were part of the main problem, to be honest, in regard to the Jews. Well, what happened was the British came to the UN and said, you know what, we're done, we want to drop this mandate off to the UN. We don't want to govern this area anymore. And so what happened on November 29, 1947, famously was the UN General Assembly Resolution 181, which is called the Partition Plan. And what the Partition Plan was, I don't know why you can see that, but basically the tan part was supposed to be Jewish. The purple part was to be Arab, okay? And now you can see that doesn't really make too much sense from the standpoint of country. You can see that would not be a very easy, a country that would be very easy to defend. That's been Israel's problem all along, but that's even worse than what they have now. Well, when that partition plan was announced, the Jews accepted that plan, and the Arabs immediately revolted against that. They immediately rejected it, and they started guerrilla violence against the Jews immediately, starting again in the fall of 1947. And there was, again, the Jews resisted that violence, and this started what was called the War of Independence. They declared their independence on May 15, 1948, again, about 6 months later. David Ben-Gurion, there he is, announces I think this is in Tel Aviv, I'm not sure, announces their independence. That's David Ben-Gurion. Do you recognize the picture above him? That's Theodore Herzl. He does look a little like Stonewall Jackson, doesn't he? That's Theodore Herzl, the father of Zionism. Okay, so David Ben-Gurion, and just to let you know who David Ben-Gurion was, he was born in Poland. He was the first prime minister of Israel from 1949 to 1963. He has a whole history, interesting, guy. But you have to understand, just so you know, the first president was Chaim Weizmann. The first prime minister was David Ben-Gurion. Now, you have to understand, in Israeli politics, the power is with the prime minister, not the president. The president is more like a figurehead. The real power, you know, the real leader, if you will, is the prime minister. And David Ben-Gurion, he's kind of like our George Washington. You know, I mean, he's the first president, the first prime minister. So now at that point, okay, everything changes. Because now, not only the Arabs in Palestine or in Israel are against an independent Israel, but all the Arab nations immediately declare themselves against Israel. And in fact, when they declared their independence, there was immediately a war. Not just Palestinians fighting against Israel, but now actually the Arab nations invade Israel. And so we enter into this new section. I call it Wars of Survival. I made that up. But there were basically four wars over the next 25 years that almost resulted in the annihilation of the country. I mean, it really, when you actually read about the wars, they weren't real long wars generally, but they were. It's truly miraculous that they survived them. This is a nation that was just born. They hardly have any organized military, and at least initially. So these are the four wars that we'll talk about again briefly this evening. War of Independence started immediately after they declared independence. The Suez War was in 1956. The Six-Day War in 1967 is maybe the most famous and most dramatic. And the Yom Kippur War in 1973 was maybe the most potentially overwhelming. They almost truly were annihilated in 1973. After that time period, the whole dynamic changes. It's almost as if the Arabs have said, okay, we're not going to annihilate them this way. And so now the tactic changes after that. But let me go just through these wars briefly. The war in 1948, the War of Independence, was really a response to the Declaration of Independence. They were invaded almost immediately when they declared independence by five Arab nations, Jordan, Egypt, Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon, from all directions. Now, when you think about the fact that Israel really had no standing army, they had very quickly immigrants coming in from Jews from other parts of the world coming in to fight this war. But they had very little training, and it really is kind of a miracle that they survived. This was to be a war of extermination. This is what Azam Pasha, the Secretary General of the Arab League, said when they went in. Says it will be a war of annihilation. It will be a momentous massacre in history that will be talked about like the massacres of the Mongols or the Crusades. That's the kind of language. It didn't turn out quite the way they planned. So the war ended basically on January 7, 1949, with a truce. And the Arab nations signed an armistice, all except for Iraq. But they did not recognize Israel's independence. And it was kind of like a cold peace. It was just basically an end of hostilities. Through this war, Israel actually extended its territory. And not to the extent that it has now, but it did expand its territory beyond the partition plan that I showed you. And Jordan annexed the West Bank, and Egypt controlled Gaza. Okay, so if you look at this, these are the borders in 1949. This looks a lot like Israel today. The difference is this. This here, which is called the West Bank, is at this time, okay, at the time of independence, was not under Israeli control. Jordan came in and ruled the West Bank. Egypt came in and ruled Gaza. And you can see here that Syria is in control of the Golan Heights as of 1949. This is a very, very difficult. These borders are almost impossible to defend. When you realize the distance that is here between the West Bank and the Mediterranean Sea and all the major cities that are here, that's very vulnerable, very difficult to defend. You have almost no response time to any kind of air attack because it's so close. No borders or room for air. There's one other thing you have to say about the War of Independence. This is what started what became known as the refugee problem, the Palestinian refugees. And a big deal was made of this for decades. The truth is, what a lot of people don't realize is that, okay, they left Israel in the spring of 1948 over a period of about 3 months. The Palestinians actually left, the Arabs left Israel. They left of their own accord. Israel did not chase them out. Israel did not attack them. Israel did not take their property. They left on their own accord. In fact, they were encouraged to leave by the Arabs. The Arab nations basically told the Arabs in the country to get out so that we can come in and destroy Israel, and when we're done destroying Israel, you can come back and take over the property. That's what they told them. They never defeated them, but these refugees now were in, again, neighboring countries, and the neighboring countries refused to integrate them. It has been pointed out often that there were lots of refugees after World War II in many different parts of the world, many different parts of Europe. Those refugees in all those other areas were basically brought into, basically assimilated into the neighboring countries in a matter of a year or so. Okay. the Arabs refused to assimilate these people. They actually kept them in camps and in poverty purposefully. It was a great political tool. Okay, they did, and by the way, there were just as many, this is not known oftentimes, there were just as many Jewish refugees out of Arab countries that came to Israel and were forced out of their homelands in Iraq, in Jordan, in all these other Arab countries. They were forced out of their homes where they had lived for centuries, and they were forced to go to Israel, and they resettled in Israel. They don't talk about that. But this was made a big deal of. They were encouraged to leave by Arab nations, and they were kept in poverty by Arab nations. But this became, again, this became the whole center of the Palestinian, PLO and so forth eventually, the whole refugee problem. By the way, this is still a problem. When Arafat, back in 2000, declined Barak's very reasonable offer, which was amazing, he wanted the right of, I think it was 5 million Arab refugees to be able to resettle in Israel. Do you know what that would do to a country? 5 million? I mean, no country that size in their right mind would accept that. But this is the kind of games they play. So 1956 then, Suez War, this is a few years later, Egypt basically closed the Suez Canal to Israeli shipping, which was against the peace that they had signed, the peace that they had signed. But at any rate, they closed the Suez Canal and they blocked the Straits of Tehran. And if you look at Israel, this basically shuts Israel out of all of Asian markets, out of the Persian Gulf, oil. I mean, you'd have to go, they would have to literally go all the way around Africa, out the Mediterranean, out around Africa, and go over to Asia. So this was a major problem for Israel. And they were doing other things. There was some violence against Israel. So Israel attacked Egypt through the Sinai Desert. And basically, this ended with a ceasefire. This was a success for Israel, but the UN basically stepped in and enforced the opening of the Suez Canal and ended this violence. But if you look at this, this is a map, again, of the Sinai Peninsula, and you can see here, here is the Suez Canal. Suez Canal obviously takes things from the Mediterranean down into the Red Sea and out into the Persian, or out into the Indian Ocean, which is, China, India, Persian Gulf, all of that. Okay, and here, the only other way that they could gain access was through their port, which is right here. Israel has a port, Eilat, that the Gulf of Aqaba. Well, here's the Strait of Tehran, and this is what they closed. So they closed this off, they blocked that, and they blocked this. And, so that's why Israel attacked. Well, through that war, the Suez War, Israel gained a lot of international respect militarily because of what they did. And they had to be held back, as they did in almost all these wars. They were forced to retreat. Now I have my little red arrows. Okay, Six-Day War is the most famous war. This was in 1967. And this time, Egypt and Syria were preparing for a war of annihilation. Again, they were amassing large numbers of tanks and troops on the borders. And Israel realized that it would be overwhelmed. And so on June 5th, they launched a preemptive strike, completely unexpected. And it was incredible. I mean, they completely destroyed the Egyptian Air Force, which is the largest air force in the Arab world, before it ever got off the ground. And they won an astounding victory. They were attacked then by Egypt, Syria, Jordan, and Iraq simultaneously from, again, north, south, east. And their success was such that it was creating a crisis, as the Yom Kippur War did as well, between the U.S. and the Soviets. So again, they were forced to kind of basically hold off. There was a ceasefire on June 11th. But the results of this were impressive. They gained the Golan Heights. Now you have to understand, the Golan Heights are, again, up northeast of the Sea of Galilee. Golan Heights are very important strategically, because it's the high ground, and basically the Syrians can just launch their missiles into Israel and without any any resistance. So they took the Golan Heights from Syria. They took the West Bank from Jordan. They took Gaza from Egypt. And they took the whole Sinai Peninsula from Egypt. Okay, so they... And here's a map. Again, it's kind of distant here, but this is the Sinai Peninsula. Now, the Sinai Peninsula, I'll say more about this in a minute, but it was very important because it was a buffer zone for them with Egypt, because Egypt would tend to mass its forces in Sinai, right? Before, so this is kind of desert, but it's a buffer zone from a standpoint of war protection. This is Gaza right here, and again, the West Bank and Golan Heights. This is what they took. So this is, you know, as of 1960, you'll hear sometimes in the negotiations that they want Israel to go to the pre-1967 borders. And what they mean by that is getting out of the Golan Heights, getting out of Gaza, and getting out of the West Bank. Okay. And now, Sinai, they had to give up eventually in their peace with Egypt. And I'll say more about that in a minute. The Yom Kippur War was in 1973. This was the complete opposite. This was a surprise attack from the Arabs. The Jews were not expecting this. And they were attacked on Yom Kippur at 2 p.m., and that's right at the height of their fasting, and they did this on purpose. Most of the military was on leave. There were literally, I have the numbers here in a minute, but this was on the Day of Atonement. They were truly caught by surprise. They were attacked by Egypt, Syria, Iraq, Jordan, Algeria, Morocco, Saudi Arabia, Tunisia, and Sudan. All of those had troops in that war. They were invaded by all those countries, more or less. And many of the leaders in Israel at the time suffered after this politically because they were caught off guard. And Golda Meir, who was the prime minister at the time, said that she did not preemptively strike because she feared that the U.S. would not enter into the war on their side if she had struck first, which I think Nixon later confirmed. But at any rate, she suffered from this politically because of they were caught by surprise. 180 Israeli tanks faced over 1,400 Syrian tanks. At the Suez Canal, 436 Israeli infantry were poised to fight over 80,000 Egyptian soldiers. The attacks by Egypt and Syria were backed by 9 Arab states as well as the Soviet Union. So this was a major attack, and it almost overwhelmed Israel. In fact, it is kind of a miracle that they survived. There is the famous phone call that Golda Meir made to President Nixon in the middle of the night. Golda Meir, who was the prime minister, called Henry Kissinger, who was the Secretary of State at the time, and he hung up on her. And he told those around him, he said, let Israel bleed a little. That was his comment. And so Golda Meir, at 3 a.m. in the morning, called President Nixon and had a famous conversation begging the U.S. to send supplies. And Nixon immediately sent supplies, and there was an airlift. Eventually, over 800 planes brought an amazing amount of munitions and really saved Israel. I mean, Nixon sometimes is called the deliverer of Israel in this war, but very famous incident. But at any rate, this is Golda Meir. She was prime minister, very interesting lady, born in Kiev. By the way, a lot of these Israel leaders are from that part of the world, Russia, Slavic. She moved to Palestine with her husband in 1921, and she was actually one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, not ours, obviously, their Declaration of Independence. So at the end of this is part of the problem Israel faced was the Arabs threatened an oil embargo on anybody who would help Israel, and that's exactly what happened when Nixon went and asked the Congress for $2.2 billion in assistance for Israel. Immediately after that, the Arabs announced an oil embargo. And if you were alive back in 1973, you remember that. I know I do. I wasn't driving at those days. I was only about 6 years old. But the oil embargo was very serious. And this was always, by the way, politically, the thing that the Arabs had over the West. in the whole issue with Israel, oil, because we were so dependent on Arab oil. After near disaster, Israel forces recovered and actually became aggressive, and they actually were moving toward Damascus and moving toward Cairo, and again, they had to be stopped. The Russians called the White House and said, you know, if Israel doesn't stop, they're going to face Russian soldiers. We're going to airlift Russian soldiers. And Nixon said, if you bring Russian soldiers, they're going to face American soldiers. So this obviously became a very serious situation. So the UN Security Council called a ceasefire on October 22nd. This was, again, caused the downfall of a lot of politicians in Israel because of they were caught by surprise. But it really was, in the end, a victory. It caused, actually, if you read about this, it actually kind of caused almost a feeling of depression to come over the Jewish people in the land, because they lost their feeling of being unconquerable. But at any rate, since that time, since those wars, it's almost as if the Arabs said, okay, we're not gonna annihilate them this way. And since that time, it has been this whole issue for the Jews of trying to find, on the one hand, peace, and on the other hand, security. And I just want to explain a little bit, really, from that time on, Israel's predicament. On the one hand, they want peace. But in order to gain peace, she is always asked to give up land. Okay, this is always the issue, right? Land for peace. But you have to understand that she's, on the other hand, she wants security. And in order to have security, she must have land. Now, when we think of peace and security, we think of them as going together. But in Israel, they're actually contrasted. Okay? Okay, she has to have land. The borders that they're asking her to have are indefensible. Okay? But in order to make peace, she's constantly asked to give up land. And this is the central piece of politics in Israel. Okay, so these are just the points which I showed you before. This is the land they're constantly talking about: the Golan Heights, the West Bank, and Gaza. But in Israel, there are multiple parties, political parties. There's the Labor Party, which is kind of the liberal party, and they tend to be emphasizing peace, and they tend to be willing to give up land. Then you have the Likud Party, which is what Benjamin Netanyahu is part of, Netanyahu. Their emphasis is on security and therefore retaining land. And this is the battle in Israeli politics. You have to kind of understand. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the goal of the Arabs. They're very clear about what they intend. Okay, so this is the Egyptian president Nasser in 1965. He says, "We aim at the destruction of the state of Israel. The immediate aim, perfection of the Arab military might. The national aim, the eradication of Israel." Now, you have to understand, that is typical of all the Arab nations around Israel. That's typical of the PLO. This is how they talk. They don't want a two-state solution. They want to annihilate Israel. And in fact, in 1974, the PLO said this. They said, our goal is to gain statehood from within that state, to continue to attack Israel, and then to create an atmosphere where there would be a major war that would completely result in the annihilation of Israel. That's what they want to do. This has always been the barrier to peace. They don't recognize, ultimately, the right for Israel to even exist. Here's Iraq president in 1967. "The existence of Israel is an error which must be rectified. This is our opportunity to wipe out the ignominy," this is before the 6-day war, "which has been with us since 1948. Our goal is clear, to wipe Israel off the map." And here's George Habash, leader of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which is part of the PLO. He says, "We seek to establish a state which we can use in order to liberate the other part of the Palestinian soil, which is the rest of Israel." So they don't want peace. They want to annihilate Israel. And they use terror. 1964 was the founding of the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization. There's our good friend Yasser Arafat, who died in 2004. He looks like a terrorist, doesn't he? He was the chairman from 1969 to 2004. And you know, they're famous for their terrorism. Of course, famously, 1972, they massacred the Israeli Olympic athletes in Munich. They unbelievably gained observer status in the UN, in 1974. In 1976, there were the hostages at the Entebbe airport. Famously, the Jews came in and rescued those hostages. 1987, the PLO was banned in the U.S. Now, the thing about all this is, from the beginning, the PLO was always a terrorist organization. And therefore, the Israeli government refused to negotiate with them in any way, and rightfully so. I mean, when we were asking them to do that, when we're asking them to do something we would never do as a nation, okay? They are a terrorist organization, but not only are they a terrorist organization, they have an amazing amount of illegal activity generally, like things like drug running and things like that, money laundering, you know. It's not a legitimate political institution. Okay, it's amazing. You know where they got all their funding from? Governments, including our own. But at any rate, he looks a little more respectable, doesn't he? That's a boss. He's the new chairman. And now notice, you know, he's got the tie. He looks like a businessman, right? But listen, the goals haven't changed. Okay, they're still the same organization. He's been the chairman since 2004. Now let me take the last time here and just briefly go through the attempts at peace since that time. And again, this is just kind of an overview. There was the Camp David Accords, which resulted in a treaty between Israel and Egypt. And again, I remember that very, very vividly when I was about sixth grade. And I remember that very vividly. That was a very important, important thing. 1993 to 2000 were the Oslo Peace Accords, which broke down. 1994, Israel and Jordan peace treaty, which was also very important. 2000 Camp David summit, and then the roadmap for peace, which didn't go anywhere, but it comes a dead end roadmap. But at any rate, let me just go through these real briefly. 1978 to 1979, there you see Jimmy Carter in the middle, and do you know who's on the left? Anwar Sadat, and on the right, Menachem Begin. There they are, shaking hands. This was unreal, an Egyptian president shaking hands with an Israeli prime minister. And you have to understand, just fundamentally, what happened here. There was an agreement of mutual recognition. That is, Egypt acknowledged that Israel had a right to exist. Israel had to withdraw from the Sinai. Now, you have to understand, this was the major issue. You have to understand, Israel spent millions of dollars putting roads in, settlements, military bases, and maybe most importantly, oil fields. They gave up a very rich oil source. They were somewhere near 50% independent in regard to oil because of the oil fields in the Sinai. And they gave all that up in order to sign this peace treaty. Egypt agreed to leave the Sinai demilitarized so that they wouldn't have military there. And Egypt agreed to Israel's use of the Suez Canal and the Straits of Tehran. That's basically what this peace treaty was. Now, you may or may not remember in this, Anwar Sadat paid with his life. He was assassinated a couple years later because he was seen as a traitor. And Egypt lost its leadership in the Arab world because up to that point, I don't know if you noticed, but Egypt was always the leader in these invasions. They were always on the forefront of these anti-Israel wars. After this, they lost that. They lost that edge. They didn't have the same respect in the Arab nations. Then, and again, I'm skipping over some things, but the Oslo Peace Accords were started in 1993. Now, that's President Clinton. And you have on the left, Rabin, Prime Minister, and of course, Yasser Arafat. Now, what's interesting about this is the first time Israel sat down with the PLO. And part of this was the PLO had to acknowledge that they believed Israel had a right to exist. Now, I think they signed the paper, but I don't think they believed that Israel had a right to exist. But this is the declaration. They signed a declaration of principles. They signed this on the White House lawn in 1993. Israel and the PLO were to officially recognize each other. That was the first thing, so they would talk to each other, you know, because neither of them recognized each other's right to exist. Autonomy was to be granted progressively to the Palestinians, first in Gaza, then in Jericho, and then in the rest of the territory. So, in other words, gradually, the Palestinians, the Arabs, were supposed to be self-governing in those territories that were under dispute, the West Bank and Gaza and so forth. Israel would gradually withdraw from those territories, the West Bank and Gaza. The PLO, which became the Palestinian Authority, you'll hear Palestinian Authority now, PA, Palestinian Authority, or Palestinian National Authority, PNA. That's just the same, that's the same organization. It's the PLO, changed its name. Palestinian Authority sounds much more prestigious. It sounds more like a legitimate governing body. It was to renounce terrorism, everybody smile, and acknowledge Israel's right to exist. Now, this didn't go anywhere. This didn't get too far. It failed almost immediately because terrorism just continued. Israel continued to expand its settlements in the disputed territories. These are always the two things that go back and forth. The Palestinians say, you keep building settlements in these lands, and the Israelis say, well, you keep attacking our citizens. You keep, you know, launching rockets into our suburbs and so forth. And so this ended quickly. And, of course, there's always been and still is disagreement over Jerusalem. Now, in 1994, Israel and Jordan signed a peace treaty. This actually was a step in the right direction. Again, this is not with the PLO. This is with a country, Jordan. And that's Hussein on the left and Rabin on the right. Rabin again. And, of course, Clinton. And this treaty just normalized relations between the two countries. They had embassies and so forth. And they agreed to cooperate against terrorism in solving the refugee problem. And there were some other things like issues with borders and water. Water's a big deal over there in the Jordan River, who gets to use it and how much and so forth. So it involved those things as well. Then in 2000, there was the Camp David summit. And again, our good friend Bill Clinton, this is Barak and, again, Arafat. Okay, so now this is the time. This didn't last very long, but this was a valiant attempt. You have to understand, what Barak did was unbelievable to the people that voted him into office. Barak was considered a conservative. He was a military man. And Barak almost like gave the Kinchin sink away. I mean, he gave everything. I mean, he was willing to give 98% of the territories and half of Jerusalem. And Arafat demanded complete sovereignty over Jerusalem and the right of return of 5 million refugees. And he literally, I mean, he abruptly left and didn't even negotiate. And everyone agreed this was unbelievable. I mean, what Barak was willing to give up. And again, Barak suffered politically because of this. But he rejected that offer and departed abruptly. And in September of that year, Arafat announced the beginning of the Al-Aqsa Intifada. So there was, again, the violence started up again. So you can see a cycle here. I mean, we all know what the issues are. It's just, from a human perspective, they're unresolvable for this simple reason. The Palestinians, the Arabs, refuse to acknowledge the right of Israel to exist. I mean, that's the bottom line. Bush tried in 2003 with his roadmap of peace, and this was Sharon and Abbas. That also failed. It called for three phases. It never got out of phase one. And is all the same things. You know, they were calling the Israelis to halt the settlements. They were calling the Arabs to stop the violence. And they were calling for a Palestinian state. Same thing, over and over again. Now, if you've seen, once in a while, these guys go over there and visit with Israel and try to start something up. Kerry was just over there this year, right? You know, nothing new. It's the same thing, okay? Now, all of this, well, let me just, this is Netanyahu. I just wanted to put his picture up there. He was born in Tel Aviv, part of the Likud party. He joined the IDF in the Six-Day War. That's the Israeli Defense Forces. And he was prime minister from 1996 to 1999, and then he was also prime minister now, again, since 2009. And he would be conservative, and he would be more of the security side of it, as opposed to the giving up land for peace side of it. But the bottom line is this, that Israel is there by God's sovereignty, and I think to stay. And we know that in the end, I thought of these verses to close with Jeremiah 31. It says, "Thus saith the Lord, which gives the sun for a light by day, and the ordinances of the moon, and of the stars for a light by night, which divides the sea when the waves thereof roar. The Lord of hosts is His name. If those ordinances depart from me, from before me, saith the Lord, then the seed of Israel also shall cease from being a nation before me forever." And we can't help but think of Genesis chapter 12, where God said to Abraham, "Those that bless thee, I will bless, and those that curse thee will be cursed." And so, where is this all leading? Well, we all know, as I said earlier in the other nights, it's all leading to a peace treaty. Okay. Again, remember, you know, all these things, they're always trying for peace. They're trying for peace. There will be a peace treaty, and that will be the beginning of the end. That will be the beginning of the, they will say, peace, peace, right? And then what? Sudden destruction, 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. And we looked at Daniel chapter 9, where it speaks of that peace agreement between the Antichrist, the future Antichrist, and the Jewish people. That will give them peace for a very, very short period of time. So as you look at these events in the Middle East, again, as Christians, we love all people, right? We love Jews, we love Palestinians, we love whoever, right? We love people. Okay, but remember, from God's perspective, this land does belong to the Jewish people, and God will preserve that people. So now let me, in closing here, does anybody have any questions? I'm not an expert on the Middle East, but if anybody has any questions. I think that's commonly understood. That she asked if the peace treaty led to the death of Rabin, and I believe that is generally understood to be so. He was, as I recall, he was assassinated by a Jewish, like a radical Zionist. These guys face a lot of pressure on all sides. You know, it's one of those things where no matter what you do, you're not going to do the right thing. A lot of pressure. Yeah, but Israel's in a state where it's almost overwhelming the odds they face, and yet their economy is blossoming. Of course, especially with the finding of gas and oil, they are potentially a superpower in the future because of their finding of gas and oil. They have amazing technology, an amazing military, and they're, of course, now they're threatening to, if they need to, they will attack Iran if the world doesn't do something about their moving toward an atomic weapon or a nuclear weapon. Yes. Well, I think offshore, just offshore. Yeah. In fact, I was hearing just the other day, I forget where it was, the Russians are interested in negotiating with Israel because of their gas. They have a lot of... Yes. But they have a lot of natural resources there. Any other questions? If not, why don't we stand and sing hymn number 699, and then... After we sing, Chris, can I just ask you to close in a word of prayer?